And those will be the non-empirical formulations. And if you select one of those possibilities and say that's going to happen and the alternatives don't, you will have a falsifiable statement. And potentially you will have a prediction if you can translate from the theoretical language to the data language. And since the theory has already generated a lot of possibilities, if you falsify one, you simply move on to the next and the next and the next. And you haven't really changed the theory, you simply changed which one of the possibilities that it generated, which one of them you were going to accept at a given time. What you may find is that none of them holds. Sometimes you have one, sometimes you have the other. See, it's a wide open search for regularities, and the regularities aren't necessarily simple ones. But would you really say you changed the theory on the basis of the experiment? If I start with a theory that talks about location and movement, and then I come in with a hypothesis that when pushed, things always move north, then I do an experiment and I say, no, I guess they don't always move north. Have I falsified that theory? Have I really changed it in any important way? No. The theory is still right there, and when I say next time, well, maybe they always move south. It's the same theory. It's just another one of the possibilities that the theory generated.
Theories are things move, or don't move.
Yeah. And they can only move to another location. If they move, there is a path. See, those are the geometry of it, and that's non-empirical. If you want to say how they move, that they move in certain paths and not others, that's these various possibilities that the theory generates.
Then the important element is that some theories themselves are used because they're falsified, or their formulations are falsified regularly. That theory wouldn't be used much. People would think about and think about the formulations and use the formulations of other theories.
Sometimes it happens, but look, consider this one about the movement. Suppose that you find out that there wasn't a regular direction in which things move. However, you may be very much able to make use of the fact that it either will move or not. If you can, then you'll continue using it. Why? Because you don't need to know which way it'll move, and it doesn't have to move in any given way for you to get that value out of the theory. On the other hand, if everything depends on which way it moves, and the categories of the theory you eliminate one by one, and it doesn't move regularly in any of the ways that the theory says it could, that's when you'd probably give up the theory. But that's like saying over here, if psychoanalysts never succeeded in curing clients, they'd probably give up the theory. Not because they found it was falsifiable, because they weren't getting what they wanted out of it. And giving up something because you're not getting what you want out of it is very different from giving it up because it isn't true.
Hey, what would the difference between the two theories you just gave when you call a possibility, and that is if something is pushed and moved, it can stay in its location, move to another location, and if something is moved, it will move to the direction.
Mm-hmm. So one is a much more specific statement. If you say it'll move north, say, well, what's the contrast? What's the other alternatives? And the other alternatives is any other direction but north.
Right.
Whereas the one that says it'll move in some direction implicitly refers to north, east, west, up, down, and all of the in-betweens. So the one is a more general one. As I say, it gets at all of the possibilities, and that's why there's no way of falsifying. Whereas the one that picks out some possibility is falsifiable. But then you see, if you falsify that possibility, you simply move to another of the possibilities within the same non-falsifiable framework.
You also said that if
something happens is not one of the alternatives, then you would...
Well, yeah. See, suppose, for example, that you had a theory that says a thing will move either northeast, south, or west, or any of the directions in between. And then you push this thing, and lo and behold, the direction it goes is not northeast, south, and west, or anything in between. You say, gee, I had an incomplete theory. There were these other possibilities that I just wasn't taking account of, because I already have a framework that says there are other directions.
Is that a rejection of the theory?
Well, I don't know if you would call it that. If we added or up or down, would that be a rejection of the original one? It'd certainly be a change. But part of the new one would be identical to the old one. So it isn't as though, you know, you straightforwardly found that it was false. It certainly would have changed in light of facts.
How then would Einstein's introduction of that theory of relativity relate to the previous theories of mechanics and physics? As total, kind of total change.
No, according to him, the earlier theories were simply special cases. And indeed, so you see, the earlier theories were just ways of picking out some specific possibilities. His theory picked out all of them, and these were special cases.
Would that leave the possibility that sometime in the future, of finding, he was talking about his special case?
Yeah. In fact, he knew he was, at least he hoped he was, because he wanted a unified theory of which his theory of relativity would itself just be a special case, and nobody has found that yet. But that's the lines on which he was proceeding. Now, as we go through these theories, I hope you'll begin to get the same sense that when you see how Freud handled the problem of people and their behavior, and then Alport, and then Skinner, and then the existentialists, etc., pretty soon you begin to see, well, in a sense, they're all dealing with the same thing. They're all talking in fairly similar ways. In another sense, all they are special cases of the role of O, and the fact that any given observer may have an account of all behavior in some set of concepts. And that the set of concepts are an ID characteristic of that observer. That's like having a lot of special theories within a more general theory. Namely, one that deals with observers instead of just actors. In fact, you might call this a theory of relativity. Maybe the theory is relative to the person, the theorist. Well, it's one thing to say that, it's another to show it. And part of why we're going through all of the examination of theories is to enable you to show it and not just say it.
What would you say about Skinner? I was just reading last night about that he said his theory is not a theory, but rather a set of facts or something like that.
Well, here again. Remember, over here we're being critics. And in the same way that a person can engage in intentional action without knowing that that's what he's doing. Likewise, a theorist may have a theory that has certain characteristics and he denies it. So as critics, we have to first look at a theory, ask ourselves what it is like, and then ask ourselves what the theorist says about his own theory. How criticizable is that? Is it accurate? Is it precise? Is it misleading? Etc. Usually, theories come embedded in ideology. Yeah. I might add that the operant conditioners themselves have laid heavy stress on the contrast between what a person does and what he says he does. I might say it's poetic justice to apply that to Mr. Skinner. Well, I think that's enough, at least for this round, on empirical and non-empirical as relating the theories. Let's turn to a historical sort of notion here. One reason why I pick Alport as the next person to examine is that his theory, in many respects, is a reaction against psychoanalytic theory. And explicitly and overtly so. And so examining Alport's theory and some of the things he does will give us a kind of line on what there is in psychoanalytic theory that people might object to. Now, in the main, there were two sorts of things that Alport objected to in Freud's theory. One is the implication that people are fundamentally irrational and lacking in access to themselves. The statements to the effect that all of the basic things about a person are unconscious amount to saying that the basic things about a person are things he has no access to. Now, in psychoanalytic theory, if you choose to take certain things literally, it's not merely you, but the real world you have no fundamental access to. Remember, that process of displacement does not guarantee that the ideas that you generate are correct, accurate representations of what's out there. Furthermore, there's no guarantee that if they were not accurate, you'd have any way of knowing it. Indeed, the implication is if they weren't, you would call ego defense mechanisms into play and you wouldn't know it. So there is this feature in psychoanalytic theory, that the nature of the terminology, the kind of discussion that went with psychoanalytic theory amounted to saying that people were fundamentally irrational and that they had no, in principle, access to themselves or the real world. All they had was their own subjective, biologically caused ideation. Well, you can see that this might rub people the wrong way. They might find this objectionable. The other main aspect had to do with uniqueness and individuality. See, one of the consequences of having a universal instinct which doesn't change in the course of development is that differences among people are relatively incidental and unimportant. They're all basically the same. They're all basically biological organisms. And the differences among them are simply historical accidents that are of very little importance in the scheme of things. And they're not fundamental, because they are simply the historically accidental displacements resulting from the organism's history. Well, you can see that that could rub people the wrong way, too. People have a strong tendency, via maxim one, to say, but I'm me and I'm unique. And it's not unimportant, and it's not just accidental, and on and on. So a theory that has these kinds of consequences or implications or presuppositions, you can figure, is going to be objectionable to other people. You might ask, looking backward, why would somebody come up with a theory that had these implications? Surely Freud recognized that they would be objectionable too. Well, you may recall I said methodologically you don't get something for nothing. The reason that Freud was willing to have a theory with these implications is that the theory had something else that he valued even more. And that is that it was scientific. It was biologically based, and it was a causal theory. And for Freud, that counted for more than preserving some of these other observationally based aspects of people. And so he was willing to say, well, even though it doesn't seem that way, it really is that way. Even though people don't seem to themselves to be caught in a causal network, it really is that way. Even though people seem to have choices, they really don't. Even though to people their individual uniqueness seems more fundamental, it really isn't. So you might say those were the kind of prices that he was willing to pay for the other values that his theory contained. Now, not too surprisingly, what you have in Allport is somebody who was determined to preserve exactly those things that Freud was willing to give up. Even if he had to give up the other things that Freud was most concerned to preserve. And so what you find in Allport is a primarily non-causal formulation with a heavy emphasis on individual uniqueness and on the fundamental validity of both of these features. Now, this particular contrast of Allport and Freud has been replayed over and over again in the history of psychology. I think it would be my choice for the fundamental division in psychology. And there are various ways of formulating it. One of them is this, that you can start with people as you find them, and then say psychological theory has to preserve these features or it's irrelevant. Or you can start with science as it is described and say psychological theory has to be scientific and let the rest of the chips fall where they may. It is the theorists who have been most concerned with being scientific who have wound up with theories that are most, would you say, anti-humanist or non-humanistically oriented. It is the theorists who have been most concerned with preserving the human features of people that have wound up with theories that have been criticized most as being unscientific. And the other two theories that I want to be sure to cover, namely Skinner and the existentialist, are a replay of exactly the same little conflict. But now in a 1970 idiom instead of a 1930 or a 1920. Okay, now. Let's move from that kind of background consideration to what did Allport say. And what we find is that he was even less systematic than Freud, although fortunately he didn't write 20 volumes. So it's easier to find what Allport said and locate it in primary sources than it is with Freud. Allport also didn't change his mind as much from 1937 to 1967. His later writing was not that different from his earlier writing, which is not the case with Freud. Mm-hmm. I think that Alport and Lindsay do comment that you have to be charitable in talking about Alport's theory, because he never did have what a good methodologist would call a theory. He had a lot of statements in various places, and you could read those and figure out, here's what he thinks. But there was no place where he wrote down a body of statements and that you could point to and say, that's Alport's theory. Now, this is true for most of these people, but it's particularly apropos for Alport. So it means that we need to rely all the more heavily on what we bring to an examination of these theories, if we want to consider them as theories at all. That's one of the reasons why I introduced these three questions as guidelines, because we can ask of Alport, what was his answer to question number one, namely, why do people do what they do? And what was his answer to why do people do what they do? No. That's his answer to why don't people do what they used to do. Say some more about that. Well, let's look in the book and see what Alport says about traits. Or what Hall and Lindsay say Alport said about traits. Turn to page 264 here. Does anybody have a book? Okay. Let me read it to you. It says, a trait is defined as a neuropsychic structure having the capacity to render many stimuli functionally equivalent and to initiate and guide equivalent, i.e. meaningfully consistent, forms of adaptive and expressive behavior. A neuropsychic structure is like ego psychology that says you don't have one from the other. You have them both there, and they work together. There's not an inharmony in principle between them. And so it's not so much biologically based as, would you say, biologically reconciled. Because your body doesn't act in a way that's incompatible with the way you act. Well, ask yourself, what would a neuropsychic structure be? See, it's different from a purely psychological structure like the locus that we identified with the source in the Freudian instinct. The locus was a physiological structure, a physiological place. But would you say that a neuropsychic structure was a place? A place where? Certainly not in your body. Well, you can see that the word is a kind of a weasel word, and that once you look at it closely, you wonder just what the heck what sort of thing this is that he's talking about. And if you stayed there, you might easily come to the conclusion he was talking nonsense. You say, well, there is no such thing as a neuropsychic structure. What the hell is it? Then I think you'd be justified. On the other hand, if you ask how come he would talk this way, what was the point? Then all you've got to do is think back to Freud and you see what the point was. That what Freud has said that historically you had to have a physiological explanation in order to be scientific. Well, with Allport, you see, he still wants to keep the physiology in the picture theoretically. Because all of this theorizing is against a background in which people used to talk about spirits and animal spirits and souls and other such things that were not coordinated with bodies, and that was embarrassing. So it was to get away from that kind of embarrassment that the requirement was put, you got to do it physiologically. And here Allport is hitting a middle ground where theoretically he's saying there is no inharmony, there is a correspondence, there is a coordination, but he's also denying that the psychic aspect stems from or is founded on the physiology. What he's doing is refusing to give the physiological priority over the psychological in the way that Freud did. But to do it, he's got to invent this peculiar thing called a neuropsychic structure. Now, the other feature is that Allport wanted this thing to be real. In some of his other writing, it comes out explicitly that Allport wanted to deny that personality was simply something in the eye of a beholder. That it was simply a way of talking, somebody's way of talking, but that there was nothing real corresponding to it. And here again, you'd probably wonder, why was he worried about that? Since that's not something that most people worry about now. It's not a familiar sort of controversy. But again, history comes to our rescue. Back in 1920 and 1930, it was. In those days, lots of people were arguing about whether things that we talked about were real or whether they were just ways we had of talking. And it followed that if they were just ways we had of talking, then they weren't real. And what Allport wanted to preserve is that this stuff is real. How do you guarantee that something is real? Well, one way is to have it be something that you can point to at least part of it. And that's one of the features of physiology and bodies. You can point to them. Okay. You can see, I can point to CJ and say, don't tell me that he's just a figment of my imagination. He's there. He's real. And I can touch him. And you can see him. And we can both hear him. If that doesn't make him real, what is? Well, I can point to the neurological part of the neuropsychic structure.
All you're basing it on is consensus.
That's a later argument.
And as you said, both of us can hear. If
yeah.
You were the only one to hear, then you would be consensus.
Right. On the other hand, with consensus, it's just our way of talking. But the fact is that both of us take it that he's really there. Anyhow, those were issues that were live issues then, and you find traces of them in the theory. You find things in the theory, wording, notions, that are there because for Allport that was an issue. And he wanted to guarantee that what he was talking about is real, and lo and behold, you have this strange thing called a neuropsychic structure. Notice that that way of talking serves several purposes. It is his way of trying to ensure that he was talking about something real. It was his way of denying that the physiological has priority. So, a la Maxim 4, he's killing several birds with one stone by having this kind of notion in a fundamental place in his theory. Now, the emphasis on having it real there's a tinge of it here. Somewhere. You'll find a statement attributed to Allport that personality is something and does something. And that's where you get the echoes of this concern with it being real versus it being a way of talking. And it's not merely a personality that is something and does something. A trait is something and does something. So let's try that. Now we can fill in by saying what it is this neuropsychic structure. So the definition of a trait says what it is and what it does. And the connection is that what it is has the capacity to do what it does. Now, in dealing with Freud, we tried to reconstruct an explicit answer to the question, why do people do what they do? And the answer was, people do what they do because their behavior is instinctual. Here, the corresponding answer is, people do what they do because their behavior is an expression of their traits. Now, in order to parallel the development that we did with instinct in Freud, we would have to now go to the notion of trait as an ID characteristic and the hierarchy of traits and the cardinal, etc. traits. Let's postpone that. Just keep that in mind. So for the present, let's move to something else that we did in connection with instinct, namely compare it. With this part of intentional action and ask, what's here that's here, what's here, if anything, that isn't here, etc. See, to what extent do these two notions match? And again, notice you've got to divide it into two parts, just like with the instinct, you had a physiological part and a behavioral part. Here you don't have quite the same thing, but you do have what it is and what it does. Okay, now, is there anything in that definition that you would assimilate to a K parameter?
By rendering stimuli equivalent, we should not make distinctions.
Yeah. Well, just talking about stimuli is enough. Remember I said that in explaining the K parameter, anything that would normally qualify as a stimulus will qualify as a value of K. So as soon as you talk about stimuli, you're talking about something here. And as far as the functional equivalent goes, there's nothing here that talks about functional equivalent. What about W? Is there anything that corresponds to W? Right. That's our normal notion of motivation, is that it's because you have the motivation at a given time that you begin and do the things you do. And that's why the behavior ends when you've gotten what you wanted. Is there anything that corresponds to K?
Guide.
Okay. Now, once more, there's nothing in that paradigm that talks about equivalent forms. What about this? That's right. And now what about this? Why performance? Remember when we were defining ID characteristics, one of them was style. I said, for style notions, you define those on the basis of performance. And expressive behavior assimilates to the notion of style. It's expressive contrast to instrumental, and that's what this contrast is. And expressive means a way that you behave, whereas instrumental means what you accomplish. And now finally, how about behavior? It's clearly here. That goes with, that's the parenthetical to equivalent forms.
Doesn't equivalence amount to part of that K parameter?
Here? Or here?
Either, just the concept of equivalence. You're making a distinction by saying a distinction.
Yeah, but we have to look a little more closely at that, because why would he bring that in? Remember that we found no need for talking about equivalence up here. Why would he need equivalence in connection with the same thing? And likewise over here, we found no need for talking about equivalent forms of behavior. Why would he need to do that? Well, other than these two, again, you can see that what's the logical content, the kind of distinction that's involved in this definition, simply corresponds to the kinds of distinctions that we have here. And where there is not a complete identity, the ones here are narrower forms than the ones here, as, for example, this one. K values are a broader class than stimuli. W has more in it than just initiation of behavior. Achievement is something more than just adaptive or non-adaptive. Performance has other characteristics than just stylistic. So to the extent that they're not identity, where they're just merely the same kind of distinction, the ones here will be broader or more general than the ones here. And we're looking at something where there's two places where there's something extra here that doesn't appear in the intentional action formulation. And so that naturally raises the question, what are they doing there? How come, you know, did we really need them over here and overlooked it? Does he really need them here? And if so, why? Think again historically, what qualifies as a stimulus? So here I am, I'm looking at that chair. What's the stimulus? Well, historically the answer is something on the order, a pattern of light rays striking my retina with different intensities, different places. Or if you project that out, a pattern of color, light, distributed over space. That's the real stimulus. Now, saying that's a real stimulus, paraphrasing, that's what you're really responding to. That's what you're interpreting as a chair or something of that sort.
You can't have a stimulus without a response.
Well, here's the response. The point is, what's the stimulus here? And that sort of account runs into problems when I look over there. I say, that's a chair too. You look at it and you say, but the stimulus pattern is remarkably different. And if I look over here and there and say, those are chairs, I say, my God, look at all the difference between those stimulus patterns and these. Now, if what I'm really doing is processing stimulus patterns, and these are very different when thought of as stimulus patterns, how come I call them the same thing? How come I treat them the same way? Namely, I'll sit down in any one of them. Well, you see, somehow you've got to bridge the gap between that and maxim one. Namely, all of these things simply directly look like chairs. And when I look at them, I don't seem to myself to be processing stimuli and interpreting the stimuli as chairs. I see chairs. It's when you introduce the notion of the stimulus pattern as what's really going on and what's really being processed, that then you create the problem that different stimulus patterns are treated as equivalent. So you see, you have this paradox that what you're really dealing with are stimulus patterns. In general, stimulus patterns get treated differently, but lo and behold, there's a class of stimulus patterns that are different and get treated the same. So your general principle makes it impossible that different stimulus patterns would be treated the same. Therefore, if you want to have it be the case that different stimulus patterns get treated the same, you're going to have something in the theory that says that's what happens. And that's indeed what you have. If you start with stimulus patterns rather than chairs, you're going to have something like this to be able to talk about chairs. Now, over here, we didn't need that because we didn't introduce stimulus patterns as the real thing. We simply said whatever distinction is being made is here. And if the distinction is chairs, then it's chairs. If it's a stimulus pattern, then it's a stimulus pattern. But there's no selection as to one type of thing as the fundamental reality or the basic thing or the thing that other things really are. Whereas with Allport, he begins with stimuli as what's really happening and therefore faces the problem of reconciling what he says is really happening with what seems observationally to be happening. And this does the job. But you might say, by having this, all he's done is broken even again. You get behind the eight ball if you start with this as real. To break even, you have to introduce something of this sort. Then you're back to where you can talk about chairs. But as we started here, you can start talking about chairs. So that's why it's needed here in this formulation. It's not needed here in this formulation. Now there's a corresponding analysis here. We sort of got into that equivalent forms in talking about performance as an expression of the know-how. I said you can appeal to the same learning history for a variety of performances that aren't particularly identical. For example, if I walk out the door on three successive days, you will, in general, appeal to the same learning history to account for the walking out the door in each of those occasions. Even when there is a visible difference in how I walk out the door on those three occasions, you'll still assimilate it back to the same learning history. So there's a one-many connection here and here. Many performances can be accounted for by the same learning history. Why? Because under the relevant distinction, they are the same performance, namely walking out the door. However, suppose that you said what's really going on is movements. That's what behavior is movements. Then you've got the same problem as you have with the stimuli. Since I engage in different movements on different occasions, and in general, whatever I do is a new set of movements, how could I have learned? I would have to have as many learning experiences as I have behaviors. You clearly can't operate that way. So once you have the real thing being movements, and movements being unique to occasions, so that you never make the same set of movements twice in general, then you need a way of preserving equivalent movements to connect them to a single learning history, and that's what you have here. Now here we did not need it because we did not say this is movement. We said this is the performance of this action, and any performance of that action will be a performance of that action. And I comment that in general, performances of the same action will not be identical. So because you have that feature in these two aspects of action, you don't need something that makes the instances functionally equivalent. Now notice in both cases in this theory, you need something extra because you begin by saying what's going on is really something other than it seems. And then you need these things to get you back even. And when you have them, you are just back even, and then you can do what you can do with this. Namely, talk about ordinary kinds of behavior. So as with Freud, you can see that some of our understanding of how come Alport had this kind of theory depends on a historical understanding of where Alport fit in the historical development of psychology, what he was reacting against as a psychologist, what was the temper of the times in philosophy and in the general, what you might call the world of thought at that time, that would lead him to make this kind of commitment where most of us wouldn't today, but having made it, then it required this, or making this kind of a commitment and then needing this, or talking in this way. So once again, you can see that the theory emerges in the particular form that it does, in part because there is a certain subject matter that has to be dealt with. And that sets some limits as to how somebody can talk and still be dealing with it. But then there are other, what you might call extraneous considerations, that are primarily historical, that also act as constraints on how he's going to talk, how he's willing to talk. And if you take both of those into account, you can account for all of the features of this basic definition. In contrast, if you just read the prose, it sounds as though Alport is talking about something very different from what Freud was talking about when he talked about instinct. And both of them sound as though they were talking about something very different from what we were talking about when we said intentional action. But when you look beyond the words and the imagery and the emotional and ideological connotations that they carry and ask yourself, how do these things work together? What you find is some remarkable similarities. At least they're remarkable if you contrast them with how different these three things sound if you just read the word. And again, now we can come back to our analysis of action and say, well, if the notion of a trait carries with it the same distinctions, the same kind of distinctions as we had with action, then at once you can understand the various sorts of things that Alport can do with this notion of trait, because we've already done them with the notion of action. And we've recapitulated doing it with the notion of instinct. Now you can see that because of the correspondence, even if Alport in fact didn't, you and I could do those things using the notion of trait. And again, the name of the game is access to facts. If you're carrying these kinds of distinction, that gives you access to certain kinds of facts about people. If you make the right kinds of distinctions, then it really doesn't matter what words you use, you will have access to those kinds of facts. On the other hand, you can also bet that some of the ideologies, some of the associations that enter into the difference between talking about instinct and talking about a trait will make a difference in what a Freudian and what a Alportian would actually do. After all, it already made a difference in what they literally said. Why wouldn't it make a difference in what else they actually do? So you might say that whereas if you saw two people doing the same thing, it could quite well be that one was a psychoanalyst and the other is an Alportian, because given this kind of correspondence, anything that a psychoanalyst could do, an Alportian could do, and vice versa. Still, you would be awfully surprised if Alportians did all of the same things that the analyst did, and there was no difference. It's not that they couldn't, but you'd bet they wouldn't. And indeed, they didn't. And we already know that, so it's not guesswork. But at some points, it becomes important that they could, and that anything that you see one of them doing, the other could do and describe within his own theory. And that's one of the consequences of neither theory being falsifiable, of each of them applying to everything that you could possibly observe. And what this kind of correspondence says is, it's not only the case that they both apply to everything you could observe, they bring the same distinctions to everything you can observe. And that's why you wouldn't expect that one of them could do something the other couldn't. See, if they were just totally different sets of distinctions, then just the fact that they both apply to everything wouldn't lead you to expect that whatever one could do, the other could do. But when they bring the same set of distinctions, you ask, well, where does one of them have something that the other doesn't? The answer is they do have something different, but it isn't their theory. It's some of the other features in their histories and makeups. So you might try a ID description here. What kind of a person would find psychoanalytic theory congenial? What kind of a person would find Allport's theory congenial? Well, you could pretty well bet that it would be different kinds of people. And the fact that they may be logically equivalent doesn't change that. It would still be the case you'd expect different kinds of people would feel comfortable talking the one way as against the other. Now, if you recall that one of the important things that we did with intentional action was to put diamonds up here and talk about distinguishing among behaviors. One of the questions you can ask is, how easy is it for any of these theories, talking the way they do, namely stimulus rather than concepts, to get at that kind of fact? So remember, in psychoanalytic theory, we had to take the route of only objects, psychic objects that have a lot of energy cathected, will be part of the content of consciousness. That would lead to the conclusion that only those behaviors that as psychic objects have a lot of energy, you will know of if you're doing them. And since you can bet that others don't, that's how you arrive at the conclusion that a lot of important things about you are forever beyond your reach. Now try the same thing in terms of stimuli. What would an account of self-knowledge in terms of stimuli look like? What kind of stimulus pattern would it take for me to know that I'm talking to a group of people? As against what kind of stimulus pattern would it take to be a group of people that I'm talking to? Well, you can see that there's something thin about it there. That you might push it that way, but it would be pushing, because this kind of language, this kind of formulation certainly doesn't make it easy to get access to that. It's only because you already know that there are such facts that you would push it that way. If you didn't know, you might never know from this that there were such facts. He had no intention of being systematic, but I don't think that he would have liked it if you said, hey, Mr. Allport, your theory leaves out a whole lot of things. Particularly if you said your theory leaves out a whole lot of things that psychoanalysts do cover. Well, I think you can see that both of them aren't doing that well in terms of facilitating access to self-knowledge. And you'll see, in contrast, that existential theory does facilitate access to facts about self-knowledge at the cost of making other things murky in various ways. So again, one of the general characteristics of theories is that they make certain things easier and other things harder. They give you clear access to certain kinds of facts at the cost of fuzzing up or obscuring other kinds, or you have to work to use it to get you access to those. And that's one of the ways in which a theory then exerts some kind of influence on what the theorist does. If it makes certain things easy and other things hard, you'd bet that the theorist who uses that theory would focus more on the things that that theory makes easy and would tend to skimp on the things that the theory makes hard.
Rogers of humanism and theory of self that is tied to relating more closely to Allport than Prohan.
Well, Rogers is a peculiar theorist. He begins clearly wanting to preserve the same things as Allport does, namely human experience, the directly experienced realities of people. On the other hand, by the time he's through, he sounds an awful lot like Freud.
Yeah.
Because you have something akin to the unconscious in the organism. You have the issue of whether you do or do not experience your experience. And yeah, well, I think it shows up in his later theorizing rather than his earlier one. The earlier one you might see as another break away, but then you might say it comes the return of the repressed. Okay, for next time, read and study the issues of functional autonomy and the notion of traits and trait hierarchies, trait organization.
Are we going to go over perfume?
Well, that's part of what's involved in functional autonomy if you extend it a little. Don't forget, bring your books.